Possible with support from the Center for East Asian and Pacific Studies, hosting its second annual film series showcasing six recent films from China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan on March 12th and 13th at the Virginia Theater. More information is available at 265-0640 or on the web at eaps.uiuc.edu. AM 580 thanks Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors for its support of Focus 580. Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in Central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Earlier this month, the former chief executive officer of WorldCom, Bernard Ebbers, was charged with securities fraud. The government charges WorldCom management with falsely reporting profits, concealing the company's true financial condition. When the truth came out, the company's stock collapsed and WorldCom filed for bankruptcy in 2002. Ebbers started this company, or started his involvement with the company, back in the early 80s, supplying long-distance service to motels. An aggressive program of acquisitions made Ebbers a kind of celebrity in the business world. At one time, WorldCom was one of America's hottest stocks. Ebbers pleaded not guilty to the charges. His trial is expected to begin this fall. We thought it'd be interesting to revisit the subject and talk a little bit about the rise and fall of WorldCom this morning. And for that, we are turning to Lynn Jeter. She is a business journalist based in Mississippi. In fact, she has been the primary WorldCom reporter for the only statewide business journal in Mississippi, which was the home of the WorldCom headquarters, the Mississippi Business Journal. That's the publication. She has closely followed the company's rise and fall since it came into being. She has written a book on the subject that's titled Disconnected, Deceit and Betrayal at WorldCom, and it's published by Wiley. So it's out there if you want to take a look at it. And of course, this morning, as we talk, questions and comments from people who are listening are welcome. We just ask people to be brief, and we have to ask that so that we can keep the program going and get in as many people as possible. Anyone can call 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Ms. Jeter, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
It seems that there are a number of improbables about Bernard Ebbers, starting with the fact that he grew up in Alberta, in Canada, and ended up going to school, to college, in Mississippi on a basketball scholarship.
Right.
How did that happen? How did he get from Canada to Mississippi?
Well, it was a squirrely turn of events, but one of his best friends happened to go down there and said, Bernie, why don't you come on down? Bernie, at that time, had already failed out of two colleges or flunked out of two colleges, and he had quite a varied work background. He had been a milkman, a bartender, a bar bouncer, a car salesman, a truck driver, all of that. So his buddy said, come on down and see what you think and see what we can arrange for you. And that's how he landed down there.
Mm. And after college, he decided to stay.
He did. He really, it was an odd fit, but somehow it worked. And he really did well in the environment. Mm.
After college, he did apparently a number of things. He did a little bit of coaching. He worked for a sportswear manufacturer, but then he struck out on his own. He apparently wanted to be his own boss, and he bought his first motel.
Right.
And that for him was the beginning. Do you think it just seems like he was one of these people who was cut out to be a kind of entrepreneur?
He was, and I think he could have done extremely well if he hadn't let power and greed get to him, which happens in, you know, many, many cases. But he had been a garment factory foreman. He had been a motel manager. But when he first had his first hotel, it was a dump. And if you go by there today, you would think, oh, my gosh, I can't believe this is how he started. But he and his wife, at the time, had a small infant and moved into a trailer on the property, and she cleaned the rooms, and he ran the front office, and then he had enough money to buy another one. And then he got partners involved. But he always had the majority percentage. And if he didn't have it in a particular case, he would manipulate the situation so that he did. And it was very interesting to see how even 20, 25 years ago, he could basically manipulate people. And he did it in such a charming way that, people seemed open to whatever he suggested.
He does seem to be a kind of a charismatic guy, and at least in the beginning, what was interesting about him was that he avoided the trappings of the CEO. He was famous for wearing blue jeans and cowboy boots, and I think also there's some story in the book about early on that one day somebody mistook him for the guy that fixed the copy machine.
Right. Well, that was his shtick, you know. He wanted to stand out, and when you go back and really follow and study his life, I mean, he wanted to stand out. That was part of the whole image. Hmm. He wanted to stand out, but yet at the same time kind of blend in with every man.
Hmm. He wanted to stand out, but he also wanted to be a regular guy.
Right.
Yeah. It's interesting that this company, the company that would become WorldCom, wasn't even started by Ebbers. He got involved in the beginning as an investor, so it wasn't particularly his idea.
Right. Although he liked to take credit for it. I think even the official corporate history has that he was involved from the beginning, but that wasn't the case at all. The man who started it all was Murray Waldron, and even though Murray wouldn't tell me, when I was researching the book, you know, I certainly got the feeling that Murray they got screwed over a little bit by Bernie, and then I heard that story from many different people over and over again. Basically, when Bernie got what he wanted, he had no need for that person. But Murray Waldron was a salesman, and when the Ma Bell breakup occurred, he saw what was going to happen. And he was very excited about the possibility, and he went to work for a company selling accounts just to see how it worked, to see if somebody would buy from, you know, ABC Company. That wasn't the name of the company, but just the idea to see if that would work, and it just went over so well. But to really get it started, he needed investors, and he hooked up with someone who knew Bernie Ebbers. But Bernie Ebbers back then, you know, he was known in the boardroom or, you know, for negotiating deals that he would walk away. Mm-hmm. Well, he even did that early on. You know, this man had gone to a great deal of trouble to set up this meeting several hundred miles away, and he went by to pick up Bernie at his house, and Bernie said, "I've decided I'm not going to go." And, you know, this was, the guy said, "But you can't do that. We've already set it up, and we owe it to this guy. He's gone to a lot of trouble." So anyway, they did have the meeting, and Bernie hedged and didn't want to pay the percentage to the guy who set up the deal, so he even got that waived. But it's just really amazing how he got pretty much what he wanted and the way he went about it.
This was the company that was called LDDS.
Yes.
Which I guess stands for Long Distance Discount Service?
Right.
Okay. And the idea was that this was after the breakup of Ma Bell, and these guys had this idea, well, they could buy up long distance and then they could resell it.
Right.
That was the idea. And it seemed that the guys who, and Ebbers came in as an investor, and it seems that the guys who were running the company didn't do a terribly good job. I think by the end of their first year, they were something like $1.5 million in debt. And then they asked Ebbers, because he seemed to do pretty well running his motels, they asked him if he would run the company.
Well, that's true. But then you also have to remember that some of the people that he got to invest in LDDS early on were some of the same people that he was pretty much in control of through the hotel chain.
Hmm.
And one of the reasons that they were losing money is they couldn't figure out how to get the switch to work efficiently. And they did need more money, and you know, at one time Bernie Ebers did, even though he wasn't running it, did put his name on the line to borrow money to get it rolling a little more. But there was a meeting that they were very much in debt, and it was before Bernie had decided to take over, and one of the original board members said, "I remember we had that meeting and we prayed for somebody to come along and buy the company, that we would have sold it to them because it just was not working." And then Bernie stood up and said, "If we're going under, I at least want to pilot the ship." And this was in early 1985.
Mm-hmm. So this was just only a couple of years after the company started, and also several years before it went public.
That's true.
Do you think that he somehow had in his mind the notion that at some point he would take over?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I'm sure from seeing a lot of the, from seeing several patterns, that he knew exactly what he wanted to do. He was just waiting. It's just like negotiating a deal and walking away from the table. He was just waiting.
Let me introduce again our guest. We're talking with Lynn Jeter. She is a Mississippi-based business journalist. She works for the Mississippi Business Journal, which is the only statewide business journal in Mississippi, and has been the primary reporter on WorldCom for a long time. In fact, she was followed this company even before it was called WorldCom, back at the time that it started in the early 1980s. She's written the story in her book, Disconnected, Deceit and Betrayal at WorldCom. It's published by Wiley, and questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It seems that once Ebers came in, he fairly quickly started what would become a very aggressive program of buying up other companies that were in the same business. And also very quickly there at the beginning, LDDS started making money.
Right. And he began buying up companies, but also he was kind of an equal partner at the time he took over. But an acquisition, one of the first ones that he made was in Jackson, Mississippi, the capital of the state, and it was AMC. And by buying that totally on his own, by also risking everything to buy it totally on his own, and then including it into the umbrella, he had majority ownership again, just like he did in the hotel chain. And he began buying more and more and more. But he needed stock. The company needed to go public. And ironically, the company that they bought to go public was also a publishing company, in part, that was going bankrupt. So, you know, he bought it for a good deal, a good bargain. And then he had stock to trade, and that's when the acquisitions really took off.
Hmm. I've read some comments by some of the people who had worked in the company saying that they thought maybe part of the problem, ultimately what happened, was that the pace of acquisition was just too fast. He did 75 acquisitions, Ebers did, over a period of 15 years, and it seemed that they just went from one to the other, and the company itself kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and that somehow there was never really the chance to absorb the new companies, to take a moment to take stock, to look at what they were doing and how they were doing it. It seemed as if the part of the problem was this relentless pace of growth. Is that true, do you think?
Well, that's true. I mean, he acquired so many. There were so many accounting systems, so many different corporate cultures, just on and on and on. You know, it got so big to the point where somebody in accounting said that, you know, they didn't even know they had equipment over in, you know, such and such. It's just really amazing that it kept pace as well as it did, and that the company kept making money without having to stop. And I mean, there was just no stopping. It was like running as fast as you can without any water.
Mm-hmm. LDDS went public in 1989, and at that time was selling for 84 cents a share. At its peak, apparently, in 99, WorldCom was worth $64.50, so that's a pretty good run-up in share price.
Absolutely. I forget what exact the figures were. 7,000% growth? What? I don't remember. But it was phenomenal.
Yeah. Then in 1995, that was when the LDDS became Worldcon.
I believe so.
And hired Michael Jordan as spokesman.
Right.
So it seemed that, again, here, though, that one of the things that Ebbers was pretty good at was the flamboyant gesture. And again, this goes back to this really interesting mix of things that he liked the notion of being every man, except it seemed that also over time, one of the things that he really got to like was the fact that he was very powerful, that it was a big company, that it was lionized by Wall Street, and maybe also that he was making a whole lot of money.
Absolutely. You mentioned Michael Jordan. One of the things that was so interesting about his move doing that is in the very beginning, Murray Waldron kept saying, Bernie, you need to spend some money on advertising. We need to market the company, and he didn't want to do it. But that finally they did agree to, I don't know who got him, but there was some guy who came in and put together a commercial, and I remember seeing it, and I remember scratching my head thinking, who's this commercial for? But it's an old man, and I think it's in the rain, you know, with an umbrella, and it mentions the competition 11 times, and it only mentions the company name like three. So by the end, you're like, who's the ad for? So it was a big deal to have Michael Jordan, but that it was just very interesting the way he strategized.
Hmm. Probably the, you know, we talked about the fact that there was this really relentless number of acquisitions, and that the company was growing very, very rapidly. The big deal, I suppose, the biggest deal of all, was the purchase of MCI.
Right.
And, this was in 1998.
Right.
How did that come about?
Oh, well, let's see. I don't remember. I don't have my notes in front of me, but I think British Telecom was trying to buy it, and Scott Sullivan had run into somebody who, before he boarded the plane, if I'm remembering this right, that said they were having some trouble, and Scott Sullivan put pen to paper, so the story goes, on the plane, and got very excited and told Bernie, we can do this. We can pull this off. And they did. So that was quite the coup. And at that point, everybody thought, oh, my gosh, they're infallible. But that was really, after that acquisition took place, that was really when trouble became very apparent, at least from the inside.
Yeah. Well, that was certainly near the peak. As we said just about a minute ago, the peak of the price, the highest it ever was in 1999.
Right.
And after that, there was a fairly precipitous decline. And it was I think you have here in the book that in January of 2001, the stock closed below $10. So that's a pretty big drop from that whatever that was, almost almost $65, so $64.50 in 1999, down to less than $10 right at the beginning of 2001.
Right.
Well, what did it mean to the company, you know, other than the fact that it made them look like they were invincible corporate buccaneers, that they could buy MCI? Was that actually, on a purely business sense, was that actually a good move for WorldCom to have made?
No, it wasn't. MCI was bloated. MCI had a totally different corporate culture. You've got basically the North versus the South, and you've got the South telling the North what to do, and that didn't go over very well. Then, again, you still had all of this fallout from all of the other acquisitions where there were so many different accounting systems in place and just so many different duplications. And just even with it, just created an incredible culture clash inside the sales organization. And the right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing.
Hmm.
But the final nail was when the Sprint deal failed. And also, there was a flare-up between John Sidgemore, Scott Sullivan, and Ebers with Nextel. If they had acquired Nextel, I think that would have been a very smart move. But it came down to Sullivan wanted it, and Sidgemore saw, Sullivan did not want it. And Sidgemore saw that it was a very good piece to the puzzle, and Bernie Ebers had to decide who to side with, and he went with Sullivan. And when Sidgemore left, he still had a title, but he basically left the power trio. Everything really went downhill. Sidgemore was a much more valuable player than anybody would have known, and it's a shame that he died in December, and very little notice was made to it.
The other man that you mentioned, that Scott Sullivan, he was the former chief financial officer of the company.
Right.
And on the same day that Bernie Ebers was charged, he pleaded guilty to securities fraud and filing false documents, and he's looking at a pretty serious prison term, although he apparently has agreed to cooperate with the government. And it seems that he seems to be performing a similar role to that of Andy Fastow over at Enron, who was also the chief financial officer of that organization and who has agreed to cooperate with the investigation there and no doubt provided information about what his bosses knew or didn't know in connection with, I guess, working out a kind of a deal on what kind of sentence he would have. Given the fact that it seemed that Ebers and Sullivan were very close, is it all surprising to you that Sullivan has turned against his former boss and is cooperating in the case against Ebers?
Not at all. I'm surprised it didn't happen sooner. I think Sullivan was waiting for a little sweeter deal because he has a daughter. I don't know how old she is. I think she's just a baby, and I think I've heard his wife is sick, and I'm sure she is after all of this. And he didn't want to spend his life in prison, so I'm just surprised it didn't happen sooner.
Hmm. We're just about at our midpoint here. And I'd like to introduce again our guest for anybody who might happen to have tuned in the last 10 minutes or so. We're talking with Lynn Jeter. She works for the Mississippi Business Journal. It is the only statewide business journal in Mississippi, which was the former home of the WorldCom headquarters. She has been the primary WorldCom reporter for the journal for some time now and has been following that company even before it was called WorldCom. She is a native Mississippian and is the author of the book Disconnected, Deceit and Betrayal at WorldCom. It's published by Wiley. And people who are listening, if you have questions, you could certainly give us a call, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois or Indiana, and that is 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here to bring in, and the caller is in Urbana on line number one. Hello.
Hello. I wanted to see if Ms. Jeter knew anything about how Bernie Ebers is perceived there in Clinton, Mississippi. I know when you're driving down the interstate that that WorldCom building is pretty imposing, and I heard that he was a pretty generous benefactor to Mississippi College, so I wondered, you know, how he's seen now and what they think about him. Thank you, and
sure.
I'll hang up.
Okay, well.
Wow, you're right. I know you must have been there, and he was a generous benefactor. It was just incredible after all of this happened how much undying support that he had from people who just simply refused to believe that he could have had a part in such a conspiracy. But after he was indicted, things seemed to turn a little bit. You know, a few people have said, well, you know, it's about time. But I know that one lady in particular, she's the widow of the college basketball coach under which Bernie was coached. And I talked to her on the phone not long after the bankruptcy was filed. And she said, I just can't believe that my Bernie would have done that. I used to give stock as gifts for birthdays, anniversaries, weddings, graduations, and he just couldn't have done it. And I felt terrible for her because she was quite an older lady, and she was crying on the phone just talking about it. And but then people have started to go, well, I'm not surprised.
It's really, again, striking how he and his personality, what an important role that played in what happened with the company in its success and perhaps also its failure. And you do have to, again, remember just how many people believed in him and how strongly they did. He was a local hero. People in the community believed in him. Stockholders believed in him. People on Wall Street believed in him. A lot of people believed in him.
Yes, and it was interesting that people had so much faith in him because, you know, if you go back to his background, he just didn't seem groomed to be in that position. Let me tell you about something that happened when he was in college. The caller mentioned Mississippi College, and this was fascinating when I found out about it, but he was there on a basketball scholarship, and between his junior and senior year, he was coming back in the summer. He was coming back from Canada, and I think he was dropping off a friend in Michigan and got into kind of a bad part of town. I think he had car trouble, and he asked some guys for help, and they were the wrong people to ask. And in all the fray, his Achilles tendon got cut.
Yeah, so, somebody threw a bottle at him or something?
So he couldn't play basketball, and he thought, well, you know, well, how am I going to finish out college? So he created a scholarship fund for himself. And it was incredible because he had all kinds of people sending him money for this scholarship fund, and I'm not just talking one or two people or, you know, some rich folks that chipped in a little bit, but I mean, just many, many people that gave money for him. Plus, he got a job as an assistant, I think, for the varsity team. So he pretty much had the senior year covered financially.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we should be a little bit more specific, or I should ask you to be a little bit more specific about what it is that Ebbers and Sullivan. What it is that they are accused of having done?
Well, they're accused of falsifying records. Let's see, Bernie Ebbers has three charges of, fraud, conspiracy to commit fraud, falsifying SEC filings. And a new charge he may face is insider trading, I believe related to his only big stock sale, which occurred September 28th. 2000, and it was in September, around that time, that Scott Sullivan allegedly went to Ebbers and said, we're not going to meet our expected earnings, and this is when everything was set in motion.
Hmm. So essentially what happened was because of what we have talked about, perhaps that the company grew too fast, it wasn't well managed, you know, whatever. After the peak in 1999, where things started going down and down and down, the guys who were running the company saw, well, we can't have people know what the real financial condition of the company is, allegedly. And so allegedly what they did was that they cooked the books to make it look like they were making money when they weren't.
Right. And I believe that they thought that things would turn around, that this would be temporary, and that no one would be the wiser, and when it just kept going down, it was a train that couldn't be stopped.
It seems that that one of the strategies that Ebbers has taken is it's very much like the kind of strategy that Ken Lay, going back again to Enron, seems to have taken, and that is to say that he was up at the top. He was the big picture guy. He didn't know what was being done by people who were on the management below him. That wasn't his job. The day-to-day stuff wasn't his job. He was the visionary guy, the guy that was supposed to, you know, look down the road and pilot the ship. Do you buy that?
No. He knew everything that was going on that he wanted to know about. And everyone knew that worked closely with him knew he was a micromanager. And there was a story in the first part of the book talking about a good friend of his that worked for him. Well, I have to keep the man anonymous. But anyway, he was fired for selling stock. One thing that everybody knew was that Bernie had a list, and he knew who sold what stock. And if you worked closely in the company with him and you sold stock, he considered that an act of betrayal. Mm-hmm. And there's quite a bit more about that, but I believe they were also talking about Monrev's. He knew a lot of minutia detail. So I just feel like he had to know about this. Also, the caller had mentioned, you know, what are people thinking about this now? I had to be very, very careful when I was writing the book and talking to people, you know, right after the book came out, to say, you know, I don't know for sure if he's guilty or not. You know, I think except for, you know, an act of betrayal by someone close to him or information that we don't yet know or a confession we may never know, but, you know, I always felt like he knew everything, especially after researching and seeing all these patterns. Mm-hmm.
I mentioned the fact that a couple times in introducing you that you are a native Mississippian and have been writing about business in the Deep South for some time, and that you had, of course, followed this story for a while. Do you think that there is some way in which this story is particularly Southern? That somehow the way that it happened and things that had happened were shaped by the place that it happened, or maybe you could say, well, no, that's not really true, and it could have been Seattle, it could have been Boston, it could have been any place else.
Well, I think it could have been anywhere, depending on the circumstances. Maybe something else would have triggered it if it were in some other part of the country. I don't know, but I do know that the Southern culture is quite unique, and the good old boy system is still in place, even though it's not really referred to that much these days. And he knew how to work the system, but I think Bernie Ebbers would have known how to work the system no matter where he was.
People with the company certainly made a lot of money. Was this, did WorldCom at its peak, was it particularly good for the economy of the region?
Interestingly enough, it really didn't make that big of a difference. You know, everybody thought, oh my gosh, this is the nation's second largest long-distance carrier, and they're based in Mississippi, and that's got to make a big deal of difference. But Bernie Ebbers, really, he was a generous benefactor to Mississippi College. You know, he did some nice things other places, but, you know, it may as well, in some instances, it may as well not have even been based in Mississippi. He didn't use the vendors. Now, when it was on its way up and before the stock peaked, yes, and there was some wealth created. If you drive through Brookhaven, where he lived, you'll see that there is, it's a beautiful town, and a lot of older homes have been refurnished, and you know, and money did well there. So in some instances, yes, but overall, not really. In fact, when the company filed bankruptcy and the accounting fraud, you know, it was embarrassing because, oh gosh, you know, Mississippi's kind of got a bad reputation sometimes for some things that have happened, civil rights. It just, in some instances, seems to be the scapegoat state. You know, if we kind of say something about Mississippi, then nobody's going to notice what we're doing. And so we thought, oh gosh, you know, just hate that this happened. But as far as an economic impact to the state, it really didn't make that much of a difference.
We have another caller. Let's talk with him in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, the about your last comment. I was reading an article that quoted Sophocles as saying, "Profit is sweet, even if it comes from deception." And they also pointed out that in 1616, the governor of Jamestown stole food and clothes from the colonists and returned to England, and he was later knighted. So there's been a lot of shenanigans going on from the very beginning. I want to know, I understand WorldCom was really a lot bigger dollar-wise than Enron. Isn't that true?
Yeah.
And apparently none of it was, or just listening to you right now, apparently, or that is, I don't know if stock options given to, like, Bernie Evers and other execs, was that part of the thing going on there? That they had stock options and that they could turn them over really quick. So they pumped up the their revenue numbers, but could get out the door before anybody could see anything. Because you just said that, but I heard you say that selling the stock was a no-no in the corporation. So apparently the stock option thing didn't hit WorldCom. Is that right?
Well, I'm not quite sure I understand the question. I love the quote, by the way. Yes, employees did have stock options, and that was at all levels, and so there were quite a few people who did time it right and did make some money, and they weren't necessarily in the upper echelon or the lieutenant positions. But once they were at the top, they pretty much had to go to Bernie Ebers, kind of like going to the king and saying, I'd like to buy a car for my wife and I'd like to sell some stock and I want to make sure you're okay with it before I do it. And he would say, yes, you can, or no, I'd rather you not. I'm not sure how all that played out, but that's what I can guess from everything that I've learned.
Okay.
So, did that answer your question?
Well, I know a lot of other, I think like in Enron, for example, stock options was a big part of the take that Ken Lay took. Well, let me ask another question. I understand that in the settlement with WorldCom, I don't know if you're still in contact with these people or not, but that the executives are supposed to take training in ethics. They're forced to take training in ethics. Do you happen to know if who got the nod to train these people ethics and how that's going at all?
I don't, but I'd love to know. That's a great question.
Okay, and the last question, and I'll hang up. I'm just curious. People who have MCI as their phone service, did they see any change in service or bump in their rates or anything out of all this or not? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Okay.
No, I don't think so. I think everything pretty much kept flowing as it was, unless I'm forgetting about something. There's been quite a lot that has happened.
Well, I think it's I'm interested in going back to the point, one of the other questions that the caller asked, and looking at ways in which this may be like what happened with Enron or not. And I think one of the things that we saw at Enron was that a number of the top executives came away from the collapse of the company very wealthy. They apparently, what seems to be the case is that they knew that things were not good and they had a lot of stock or stock options and they managed to cash out and make money. It seems the situation with Ebers was different. Now, while he certainly became wealthy as the company grew and he went out and bought a lot of real estate, for example, with some of which apparently he still owns, a good chunk of his fortune was in WorldCom stock that he actually held to the point where it wasn't worth anything. So in that sense, he lost by the collapse of the company and didn't take the opportunity to cash out.
Well, that's true, except for that stock sale. September 28, 2000. He really didn't sell the stock. He held on to it. You know, some people debate whether it's out of loyalty, and some debate whether it was out of greed, thinking that it would come back up again. But no, he may be one of the biggest stock losers in the deal, because, you know, it's very likely that he will file personal bankruptcy soon, which was unimaginable several years ago when he was worth, I think, $1.3 billion.
Mm-hmm.
But he had the $408 company loan. Now, he borrowed money through stock, and he still owes $300 million to the company. And the company, I believe, has considered him in default. And he has sold off quite a few assets, including the huge ranch in Canada. So, no, he was definitely not a winner in the deal. If there's any consolation, he went down. He finally went down with the ship that he piloted.
Yeah. He did at one time own a tremendous amount of real estate. I guess this was the ranch. Was this the Douglas Lake ranch?
Right.
500,000 acres. He paid $68.5 million for it.
Right.
He paid $67 million for it, and apparently it was sold, at least according to the story that I have, for $68.5 million. So somebody made $1.5 million on the deal. So in addition to that, he apparently had a yacht building company. He had land in Louisiana, in Alabama, and Mississippi, and an office building, and owned some motels. So he apparently went out and took a lot of his money and put it into property.
Right. Well, he sure did.
But at this point, is it correct that he is pretty much broke after having had all that money and having had all that real estate?
Well, he's not broke yet. That may take a while, but at the rate everything's going, you know, there's a lot of speculation that he will file bankruptcy.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and our guest is Lynn Jeter. She's a business writer. She works for the Mississippi Business Journal, which is the only statewide business journal in the state of Mississippi, and has been their primary WorldCom reporter for a long time. In fact, has followed the company's rise and fall even before it was called WorldCom, when it started out as LDDS in 1983, and she's written about it in her book, Disconnected, Deceit and Betrayal at WorldCom. That's the title, and it's published by Wiley. And questions are certainly welcome if you'd like to get in on the conversation here. We certainly have time for a few more in the time that remains. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So what now do you think is going to happen with the company, which has changed its name, I think, last spring, almost a year ago, or a little more than a year ago, changed its name to MCI. They moved the corporate headquarters, so they're no longer in Mississippi. They moved to Virginia. What do you think is ahead for MCI?
Well, I'm not sure. I think Michael Capellas has done just about everything he can to distance himself from Bernie Ebbers, but the company, I believe it's today, that we're supposed to have, I don't have that note in front of me, but today is when MCI is expected to reveal its total accounting fraud, reached about $11 billion in its final financial restatements that will affect billions more because the company has reversed its past accounting practices. And I think Mr. Capellas had hoped the company would emerge last September, but the restatement was an enormous task. So I don't know. I think he has a huge task still ahead of him.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how he sleeps at night. But, you know, one thing with Scott Sullivan, all of the talk about him as CFO, very, very little has been said about the current CFO, Robert Blakely. You know, I don't know much about him. I know he was CFO at Lyondell Chemical and was credited with helping restructure Tenneco, which was mired in a complicated debt structure and had many unprofitable businesses. And he also recently completed a 4-year appointment on the Financial Standards Advisory Council for the Financial Accounting Standards Board. And he seems to have finished a huge task. So I don't know what will happen with the company.
Well, I know that in some of what I've read about it, at least you read people saying, you know, no telling what their agendas are, but they think that at least you have to acknowledge how quickly the company has been working on trying to move ahead to clean itself up. And I think that there's still, at least the people at MCI somehow think, or maybe that they're hoping, that they will be out of bankruptcy by the end of next month. Now,
well,
whether that's overly optimistic or not, I don't know.
Well, that does seem optimistic. So that's been interesting to watch, to see how Michael Capellas has maneuvered in this unfavorable situation. There needs to be a second book about the Phoenix Rising.
So you think it's possible there will be other charges against Bernard Ebbers still to come?
Well, I'm going to be interested to see what happens with insider trading and if anything else comes up. I don't know. I think that might be it.
And other people in the company, in addition to him and, well, Sullivan has pleaded guilty. Mr. Ebbers has been charged, and he's pleaded not guilty. The other people, do you think high-level people in the company will be charged?
I do, and, you know, what's interesting that I haven't heard a peep about is Bernie Ebbers' longtime secretary, who is pretty much the linchpin to all of this, and nobody even knows her name, Deborah Blackwell. So I think she might be asked to come forward, and I'll be curious to see what she has to say.
I think it's interesting that there was so much attention paid to the case of Martha Stewart, obviously because of who she is, and that an awful lot of people were looking at her prosecution and all the attention that the case got and said something like, well, while indeed she may have broken the law, the extent of her misdeeds were nothing when you compare them with people like Bernard Ebbers, for example, or with Jeff Skilling or Andrew Fastow or the people who were associated with Enron or indeed some of the other like people, Mr. Scrushy or some of these other people that have been charged with wrongdoing and in big companies and lots and lots of money. I guess what I thought interesting was when you go back, though, you can see, in fact, that some people might have think it took too long. But that a lot of these people, they're either have been charged, there's trials going on, that in fact prosecutions are going ahead against some of those people. And yet it seems that it doesn't quite get that much attention. And I wonder why you think that is.
Well, I don't know. I think maybe there's just been so much of it that it's all blending into one canvas. But I think that Martha Stewart being convicted last Friday surprised a lot of people who thought she might get off scot-free and who thought maybe some of these other high-ranking folks would get off scot-free. And if she had, I think people would have rolled their eyes and thought that corporate folks like Bernie Ebbers would also get off scot-free. But now that this has happened, I think people are curious to see what happens when he goes to trial in November, if it's not postponed.
Hmm. You think that it might be postponed?
I do. It would be too easy for it to be on time.
I have a caller here, and it says on my board that the caller is in North Carolina, so I'm assuming that means they're listening on the Internet. Let's go there to our toll-free line. Hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good.
My name's Randy. I just wanted to ask you why you think WorldCom, being the largest bankruptcy the country's seen, has garnered so little attention compared to Enron?
Yeah, that's a good question.
That is a very good question. I think Enron really surprised people. It was complicated. It was a house of cards. It wasn't any. It was very much manipulation of numbers and companies. MCI was very simple. Just cook the numbers, basically. And I don't know. I don't know why it hasn't garnered as much attention.
I guess being a country where we always look for the biggest record or the best or the most, it's just funny that this one has kind of slipped by the radar for so many people.
Right. Absolutely it has.
Okay, thanks.
Well, thanks for the call. That is curious because, as the caller pointed out, and I think an earlier caller did, that indeed this was bigger than Enron, and yet just doesn't seem to have gotten quite the level of attention. Well, I'm sure that there will be more attention given to it as things go ahead and as Mr. Ebbers, when and if he goes to trial. And it's a story I'm sure we'll continue to follow. I wanted to thank you very much for giving some of your time today.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Our guest, Lynn Jeter, she is a reporter for the Mississippi Business Journal, and also is the author of a book on this subject. So if you're interested in going back and learning more about the WorldCom story, you could look for her book, which is titled Disconnected, Deceit and Betrayal at WorldCom. And the publisher on the book is Wiley. Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. The broadcast is also made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated, and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. Coming up a little bit later today, as part of the Afternoon Magazine, a conversation about the difference that class makes in the lives of working women. This is an interview from the Afternoon Magazine archives, an interview with Jennifer Johnson. She spent 4 years interviewing working class women about their work lives. She's the author of a book titled Getting By on the Minimum, and you can hear that in the 1 o'clock hour at 106 following the NPR News. Celeste Quinn is the host for the show. It begins as usual at noon Central Time, and they'll have news and sports and weather, and Mike Sola will have that weather at 12:35, then that feature that's called Talk to Mike. When he's doing it, if you're going to be doing some traveling, you can get a weather forecast for your destination. That's part of the Afternoon Magazine. It starts at noon here on AM 580. In the next hour of this show, we'll be talking about new cars. And our guest for the show will be Rick Paul. He's the automotive editor at Consumer Reports. Their new auto issue is just out. We'll do that in hour two. First, an update on the market, so stay tuned.